Good morning. How are you? Good. Happy Pappy's Day to all the dads. How many guys got a tie for Father's Day? You know what? This is a great. I don't even see a hand up. I think this is. All the dads are clapping. That's good. I tell you, you know, we're in a new day when dads get rainbow sandals rather than ties. So that's great. Take your Bible and turn with me to Genesis chapter 25. We're going to pick up in a series that we began about 2 years ago in the spring, working our way through the book of Genesis. And we covered the first 11 chapters, the beginnings of all things. Then we looked at the life of Abraham beginning in chapter 12. And now we come to the next major section, the next major character in the book, and that is Abraham's grandson, Jacob. You remember that especially the Old Testament was meant to be read and heard. And so I would encourage you just to listen as I read, and then when we get back to the text, you can follow along later. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were complete, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out all red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skilled hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in the tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew. I'm starving to death." Therefore his name was called Edom, because Edom means red. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. We're going to look at, for the next 10 or 12 weeks or so, we're looking at Jacob. And Jacob, as we're going to see very quickly, is a very contemporary sort of figure. He's easier for modern people to relate to maybe than Abraham, the friend of God, the great man of faith, or Moses, to whom God spoke face to face, or David, who was a man after God's own heart. I can relate to Jacob because he has more struggles, more failures, more doubts than almost anyone else in the whole Bible. In fact, you might say that he's one of the most unheroic heroes in the Bible. And I mean, you can understand how God would be proud to say, "I'm the God of Abraham, even I'm the God of Isaac," but to say, "I'm the God of Jacob," well, but you see, the issue is, it's not about Jacob, it's about the God of. And what we're going to see in the story of Jacob is God's relentless grace. Everything that we studied through the book of Galatians is going to come in embodied form as we see God relentlessly pursuing this man, Jacob, by grace. Now, but to put the story in context, let me set the stage, because probably you weren't here 2 years ago, and we're working our way slowly, but you can get the CDs out there. But we need to review the book of Genesis, what it's all about. The first 11 chapters of Genesis tell us that the one true and living God created the world and everything in it. He created people, and his purpose, his intent for creating people, was that we would enjoy the blessing of his relationship. That we would enjoy living in a personal covenant relationship with God, where he would bless us, and we would live under His protection and His provision. And God created a beautiful place, a very good place, a beautiful garden for people to live in. And He provided them with everything they needed to enjoy Him and the life He had created for them. But early on, we're told in Genesis that the people that God created decided not to trust in the goodness of God and His promises and the things that He had provided for them. And they did the one thing that God told them not to do, and that was to eat of the fruit of the tree of good and bad, which is an apt name for the tree, because before eating of the tree, they didn't know what bad was. They only knew good. They knew God was good. They knew that everything that God had made was good. And they didn't know evil until they ate of the tree and did what God said not to do. And bad and evil and sin was and is living independent from God, living as if you were God. And you see from that moment on in the book of Genesis how the world begins to spiral into chaos. The world begins to spiral into the bad. The human race spiraling down into violence and oppression and injustice and evil and death, both physical and spiritual death. And so by the end of Genesis chapter 11, the whole world is in a state of chaos. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes, and they are hurting people, they're hurting one another, and destroying any possibility for peace and justice in the world. Every now and then somebody will say to me, they will ask, you know, if God is so good and He's so powerful, then why is the world so messed up? And here's how I answer that question. This is not the world that God created. Remember, the Bible tells us God created a very good world. He didn't want any of this for us, but He didn't want to force people to live His way. And so from the beginning, God gave people a choice. They could either trust themselves or they could trust Him. And what we see in the world today is the mess that we have made by leaving God out, going our way instead of His way. And because God respects our freedom to choose, He will not step in and fix things because that would require Him to force Himself on us. So, why is the world so messed up? Because we messed it up when we refused to trust in God's goodness and we decided we would decide what is good and bad for ourselves. Now, when you come to Genesis 12, what you see is that God comes and chooses a man named Abraham. Out of all the people on the face of the earth, God sovereignly chooses Abraham, and He tells Abraham, I'm going to save the world through your family. How you like that? I'm going to save the world through your family. I'm going to make an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants, and I'm going to make your family into a new society of human beings who will walk in my ways, a new humanity of peace and justice. And they will live in a land, he says later, flowing with milk and honey. In other words, a new Garden of Eden. And ultimately, and most importantly, behind everything else, God says to Abraham, is this promise that one day, through one of your descendants, the blessing that I've intended for the world will come. And through one of your descendants, I will reconnect people with me and restore the world to what I wanted from the beginning. And it's going to come through one of your descendants. So what the book of Genesis is about is this line of promise. It goes really all the way back to Adam and Adam's son. And you see it traces this line of promise. But it really comes into view in the life of Abraham, where God says, in one of your descendants will bear the messianic seed, and that seed will be passed on and passed on generation to generation until Messiah comes. Don't miss this. This is what the whole book of Genesis is about. It's tracing a line of promise from Abraham forward. One child will be sovereignly chosen to bear the messianic seed. One child will be the leader of the clan, the leader of the family. He is to teach his family about God and to walk in the ways of God. He passes that on to the next generation, to his children and his grandchildren, until Messiah comes who restores all things. Now, what you must not miss in this story is that God is calling a people to Himself. A people through whom he will bless all peoples. So God's got the world in mind, but he's going to do it by choosing people through whom he will bless all people. And he is sovereignly choosing certain people to carry that line on. He sovereignly chose Abraham out of all the people on the earth. Abraham had two sons, but only one of them was chosen by God, Isaac, the younger son. And Isaac marries a woman named Rebecca. And what we see in this text that we come to this morning is that God chooses Jacob over Esau. Now, you know, this gets us into this whole thing about election and free will and God choosing and our choosing. And we have a hard time with that. I think maybe you don't. I think a lot of people do. It's something that's talked about from time to time. And I think we struggle because we're told and we believe that we can be whatever we want to be. And a lot of advertising plays to that. Advertisers are out to get your cash. Politicians are out to get your vote. And they all love to play on this idea that we are, this sense that we have of individual power and freedom to run our own lives and make our own decisions that shape our own destinies. And we see that all the time. But what about, you know, just how free are we really? Well, I picked up a book this week. I've heard about this book for about the last 3 or 4 months. And people kept saying, you need to read The Shack. You need to read The Shack. You need to read The Shack. And so I started reading The Shack this week. How many people are reading The Shack right now? It's probably like one of the most popular Christian books. It's a very interesting book because it blows all your categories about God. And I'm not going to tell you really a whole lot about it, except that I'm going to read a conversation that a man named Mac has with God, who happens to appear to him as a black woman, but he calls her Papa. So God's not a man or a woman, and he's not black or white. So it kind of plays with your mind a little bit. But it's an interesting conversation. It's a little Matrix-like, you know, when Neo goes to talk to the Oracle. For those of you who are Matrix fans. Anyway, Mac turns and he's talking to God, and he says, you knew I would come, didn't you? Well, of course I did. Well, then was I free not to come? Did I not have a choice in the matter? Papa turned back to face him. Good question. How deep would you like to go? She didn't wait for a response, knowing that Mac didn't have one. Instead, she said, do you believe you're free to leave? I suppose I am. Am I? Of course you are. I'm not interested in prisoners. You're free to walk out that door right now and go home to your empty house. Just because I know you're too curious to go, does that reduce your freedom to leave? And she paused only briefly and then turned back to her task, talking to him over her shoulder. Or, if you want to go just a wee bit deeper, we could talk about the nature of freedom itself. Does freedom mean that you're allowed to do whatever you want to do? Or we could talk about all the limiting influences in your life that actively work against your freedom, like your family genetic heritage or your specific DNA, your metabolic uniqueness, the quantum stuff that's going on at a subatomic level where only I am the always present observer, or the intrusion of your soul's sickness that inhibits and binds you, or the social influences around you, or the habits that have created your synaptic bonds and pathways in your brain. And then there's advertising and propaganda and paradigms. And inside that confluence of multifaceted inhibitors, she sighs, what is freedom really? Mac just stood there not knowing what to say. I can understand that. Only I can set you free, Mackenzie, but freedom can never be forced. I don't understand, replied Mac. I don't even understand what you just told me. She turned back and laughed. She said, I know. I didn't tell you so that you would understand right now. I told you for later. Well, that's an important discussion, because right here, the subject of this part of Genesis is this: God's freedom to choose the people he wants to enjoy his blessing and extend his blessing to all people. Look at the text at Genesis chapter 25, verse 19. Genesis 25:19 says, these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Now, when Genesis was originally written, there was no chapter and verse headings like we have in our Bible now. But each section of Genesis was marked out by, these are the generations of. goes all the way back to chapter 2, verse 4. These are the generations of the foundation of the earth, which tells about Adam and Eve and the fall. And then it moves forward. There's a line. And what is happening is we're seeing that God has created, and then He's calling to Himself a people who will enjoy His presence and blessing forever. But we also know, as I just said, we know from the story, the whole world falls into a state of chaos. And so when you get to Genesis chapter 11, verse 27, you read about the generations of Terah, who is Abraham's father. And starting with Abraham, you see this very definite line being formed that God will bring about His purpose to call together a people who will enjoy His blessing and extend His blessing to all people forever. And it'll come through people who trust in His promises. Like Abraham is known to be the father of the faith. Why? Because he believed in God's promises. And he lived his life, not as a perfect man, but he lived a life of faith. Now, in this section of Genesis, we're going to see over and over again how God continues that same thought. He continues His purpose of calling out a people who will belong to Him, but it's all going to be by His free choice. The promise will pass through the people that God chooses. And if you read through the opening verses of the passage, verses 19 to 23, that point, you just can't miss it. Both the fact that it is God that enables Rebekah to get pregnant and the fact that God tells Rebekah that she's going to have twins and one twin is chosen over the other twin shows us very clearly that God is in charge. Look back at verse 19. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife. Verse 21, and Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, this is a deliberate reminder of something else we've seen in the book of Genesis, and that is Isaac was kind of a miracle baby. We know that Isaac was born long after it was humanly possible for his mother Sarah, who was 90, to give birth. And so we see in Isaac's life God taking the initiative in choosing Isaac over Ishmael. Well, now Isaac and Sarah was barren for 25 years. How long was Rebekah barren? 20 years. Because did you notice in the text, Isaac is 40 when he gets married and he's 60 when the twins are born. Okay, so a little prayer lesson there, not to be elaborated on, but persistence in prayer, you certainly can see that in this text. But the real message of the text is that God is bringing His purposes about, and He wants people to trust His promises. Okay? Now, verses 22 to 23 drive home the same point. It's God's initiative in who He chooses. Verse 22, the children struggled together in her, and she said, if it is thus, why is this happening to me? What does that mean? It means this. She's saying, if God has answered my prayer, then why all this pain and hardship? Another little prayer lesson there, not to be elaborated on, but you can. It's not the meaning of the text. But how many times do you pray for something and you get it and then everything falls apart? Doesn't necessarily mean that you missed something in the prayer. Sometimes God answers prayer and things get difficult. And what does she do? She goes back to the Lord with that. And she goes to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord gives her an oracle. Two nations are in your womb, and two people from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older will serve the younger. Again, you can't miss it. God is sovereignly choosing the child through whom the promised blessing will come. He chooses them. There's twins in the womb. He chooses the younger over the older before either one had done anything good or bad. Now, just in case we're tempted to miss this, Paul picks this up in Romans chapter 9, talking about the very same thing of how God chose Israel as the nation through whom, remember who Israel is? Jacob is Israel. Jacob's name gets changed to Israel. God chooses the Jews to be the people through whom the Messiah comes. He's talking about that in Romans 9. And when we get to Romans 9, verse 10, Paul comments on this story. When Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done neither good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of his call, she was told the older will serve the younger. And later the prophet Malachi wrote, Jacob I love, but Esau I hated. Now, by the way, the words love and hate there are not used. Hate is not personal animosity. It's used in the sense of choosing, that God chose Jacob to be in the line of promise, and he did not choose Esau to be in the line. Now, as I said, you can't miss the point. It's God who chooses, and he chooses who he wants to carry forth the messianic seed, and he's free to make that choice. It's not performance-based. It's not about how many good works we do. He will do what he's determined to do of his own free choice. And I've been thinking about that this week because, again, I said, you know, we all struggle with this. And we find it hard to take. And I think the reason is because we live with this delusion that we really are in control. And we all have the power to choose. But the story of Jacob, we're going to see this time and time again, that God is moving history forward by his choices. And when you really stop to think about it, I mean, is it really all that hard to believe that God is sovereign, that he's bringing to pass what he's always wanted? I mean, do you really want God to be the kind of maybe I will, maybe I won't kind of God, and his choices are dependent upon our choices? I mean, now surely it can't be wrong that God would be sovereign in his choice of how he brings his purposes to pass in his universe. And if it comes down to me and my decisions, you'd have to ask who's in charge, me or God. And as I've thought about it, I think the reason we have such a big problem with the idea of God choosing is that, again, we want to carry on the delusion that we're in control. But if it did work that way, if it was based on my choices, I'd be choosing the good, all the good stuff, whatever that is, how I determine it. Usually good is what makes me feel good and what I define as good. And what I would reject what I call bad. But if I was really honest with myself, if I judged myself by my own standards, I'd be in serious trouble. Because if it depended on me choosing for God rather than God choosing for me, well, I would be lost. Now, the next few verses, verses 24 to 28, show us just how grateful we ought to be that God is doing the choosing. Because here we meet the family from hell. I mean, there is nothing that illustrates the point that it is God's free initiative in choosing the undeserving better than Isaac, Rebekah, Esau, and Jacob. So if our first point is that it is God's purpose to call to himself a people who will enjoy his blessing and extend that blessing to all people, and that purpose moves forward by his choice, then our second point is that his purpose moves forward in spite of rotten, raw material, in spite of flawed people, in spite of what people might do to mess it up. And this is just an introduction, these verses here in 24 to 28. It's kind of like when I was a teenager, there was a show on TV called Soap. You remember that show? You remember that show? Yeah, I wasn't allowed to watch it. It was a spoof on daytime soap operas that my mom watched, like General Hospital and Days of Our Lives and As the Stomach Turns and all that kind of stuff. And it was very controversial for a time, but it would open every week like this. It would open something like this. Meet Barbie. Barbie is the mother of Nancy. Nancy is married to Joe, and Joe is running a large sporting goods store. Sam is Joe's brother who is dating Tammy. Last week, Tammy told Barbie that Nancy was expecting Jimmy's baby. And then it went on and on and on. And it said, confused, stay tuned for this week's episode of Soap. Well, that's kind of what we get here in verses 24 to 28. We get an introduction to this flawed family because this family makes Bart and Homer Simpson look angelic. I mean, there is dysfunction, and there's a Father's Day message in here somewhere, but this really isn't about fathers, so I'm not going to go there. But I'll just let you draw your own applications from it as we get to these points. And I'm just going to hit the highlights because the author doesn't spend a lot of time on these details. So he's preparing. He's hinting at things that are coming. Look at verse 24. When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb, but not identical twins. The first one came out an orangutan. Red, ruddy complexion, his body like a hairy cloak, like he was wearing a sweater from University of South Carolina, I guess. And so they called his name Harry. That's what Esau means, Harry. And immediately you get this mental picture of a rough, coarse, simple-minded man's man kind of guy, which fits very well with the description that we get in just a few moments, that he was a man of the field, he was a skilled hunter, and the redness of Esau, it kind of speaks of a hot-headed, impetuous kind of guy who opted for the red stew. There's a definite tie between what Esau looks like and the fact that he opts for this red stew over his birthright. It's all word plays in here. The Hebrew writers were genius when it came to telling a good story. Then verse 26, afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so they called Jacob Heels. That's what it means. I think Isaac's name was Laughter. I think he had a good laugh over naming his boys. Okay, we'll call that one Harry. We'll call that one Heels. Actually, Jacob's name has a kind of double meaning. On the one hand, it could mean may God protect. On the other hand, it's heel grabber. It's the one who trips you up. It's kind of like the word notorious. Like the word notorious originally meant somebody of great notoriety, an honorable person. But the word evolved over time to mean like notorious, meaning dishonorable, notorious gangster like Al Capone. Jacob's name is hinting at this kind of thing. He's a man who spent his life in the tents around his with his mother. He spent his life tripping people up. He was devious, deceitful, untrustworthy, a life characterized by scheming and manipulating and trying to work things to his advantage, trying to gain what God had promised him through his own efforts. And later in chapter 27, Esau says to Isaac, "Well did you name him Jacob, deceiver, because he's cheated me these two times now." So Jacob's name hints at this competitive jealousy. And we're going to see what all that means in the weeks to come. But for now, the names of these boys are hinting at what they'll be like. They're not determining their character, but they're characteristic of their lives. And then there's this matter of favoritism. Verse 27, when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was quiet, probably better translated, a whole man, a complete man, a calculating man, a man who had it all together, complex, big picture kind of thinker man, a man dwelling among the tents. And then verse 28, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Well, here we see this household torn apart. Now, what does that tell you? Each parent had their favorite. How do you think that affected family life? Do you think that worked for or against this competitive jealousy that's already hinted at? How do you think Jacob felt? And I believe very strongly that Jacob knew of the oracle that God had given his mother, that he would be the head of the clan, the bearer of the messianic seed. I believe that story was told. But how would you feel if your father ignored that because he loved what your brother could do for him by cooking up barbecued venison? You see, this favoritism it plagues the stories of Genesis. And you're going to see the very thing that Jacob hated, he will pass on to his sons. Because you remember the story of Jacob and Joseph and the coat of many colors? That favoritism is passed on. And in time, the sin of favoritism would come home to Isaac and Rebekah, because Isaac would ultimately be deceived because of his taste for wild game. And Rebekah, because of her part in the deceit that is coming, her stay-at-home son is going to be driven from home and she will never see him again. A lot of family dynamics hinted at right here at the beginning of the story. And so as we move through these 10 chapters or so, what we're seeing is God is choosing, and he's choosing rotten raw materials. Deeply flawed people, none of them escapes blame. They're all true sons of Adam and true daughters of Eve. Each one infected deeply with this universally recurring gene of the human race, and that is the tendency to trust ourselves rather than the goodness of God. And these stories are written to show us that God is calling to Himself a people through whom He will bless all people. And He's sovereignly guiding that process, and it's not based on the goodness or badness of the individuals. He's working out that plan through flawed people. And again, when we struggle with this whole issue, I just have a hard time with all this business about election and God choosing people. It just doesn't seem fair. Well, when you look at this family, nobody is deserving of the blessing. Nobody escapes blame. It's amazing that God in His goodness would choose anybody. And in here in this story, His grace and mercy are going to fall to Jacob, the deceiver. I mean, think about your own family for a moment. What husband and wife doesn't have elements of Isaac and Rebekah? What brothers, what pair of brothers or what sisters don't have something of the competitive jealousy of Jacob and Esau? Think about your own parents and how they relate to you. Think about how you relate to them. Think about how in your own home, maybe to get what you want, you have to scheme and negotiate and manipulate. See, I tell you, I see Isaac and Jacob and Esau and Rebekah. I see them all in me. I see them all in me. And yet here's God in His grace, and God has chosen to set His love on me. I know my heart. I know in my heart I find myself scheming and controlling and manipulating and negotiating to get my way. And if God's purpose to call to Himself a people who will enjoy His blessing and extend that blessing to all people, if God's purpose depended on my performance, I would be totally lost. But there is a tension in the text, because in verses 29 to 34, we see that God's purposes advance through responsible, individual, human decisions. In other words, our choices do matter. These closing verses make it quite clear that Esau is to blame. That the conclusion that the author wants us to make, like if you were listening to your dad tell this story and he got to this point in the story and said, okay, we'll pick up here tomorrow night. The conclusion that the author wants us to make, he wants us to go away thinking about Esau rather than Jacob. And Esau is a warning. Watch out. Don't be like Esau. Verse 29, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, and this is some of the most crude, not crude in a bad sense, but common Hebrew in all of the Old Testament. He literally comes in and he says, let me have some of that red. He repeats that over and over again. He says, I'm starving to death. And that's why they also called him Edom, which sounds like the Hebrew word for red. Jacob said, you really want this stuff pretty bad, don't you? Well, sell me your birthright and sell it to me now. Esau said, I'm about to die. What use is a birthright to me? Jacob said, swear to me. And he swore to him and sold him his birthright. And then the Hebrew verbs just are like, bow, 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 bow. It's like, and Jacob gave Esau bread and beans, like pinto beans, like stew, lentil stew. And he ate and drank and rose and went his way and gave it not a second thought. And Esau despised his birthright. Now, the birthright in that day and time was a person's rightful inheritance. It was the rightful inheritance of the firstborn. Each child got a portion of the father's estate, just like in the story of the prodigal son that we heard. Esau was, because he was firstborn only by just seconds, he was entitled to a double portion of his father's estate, so that when Isaac died, the estate would be divided into thirds, and he would get two-thirds and Jacob would get a third. But when you stop to think about it, in light of the whole book of Genesis, there's something much more at stake here. Because, again, all through this message, I've been saying that what Genesis is about is that God's purpose to call out for Himself a blessed people who will bring blessing to all people. And we've seen that God brings that purpose about through people who trust in His promises. And so what we're seeing here is Esau is actually despising his place among God's people. And the author goes out of his way to tell us that God's choice of Jacob over Esau is not unfair, because it merely takes from him something he counted as having no value anyway. That's the point. I have no doubt that everyone in this family heard the whole story of what God is doing in the world. Abraham lived into the teenage years of Jacob and Esau. And so he was alive to tell God's story to these teenage boys. No doubt, after his death, Isaac told the stories to his children. And I have a hard time believing, like I said, that the oracle that Rebekah had received from God about the line of blessing coming through Jacob rather than Esau, I have a hard time believing that the two boys wouldn't know that as well and would have or should have been prepared for their respective places in God's purposes and plans. Abraham most certainly told Isaac that the blessing would come through him when he sent Ishmael away. And I can't see that lesson being lost on Isaac, who himself was the promise bearer. So what's going on? Well, I don't know. Maybe the birthright didn't mean much to Esau because he knew God had chosen Jacob over him. Or maybe to Esau, the whole story that his granddad and his dad talked about, this of blessing and land and a promise and a future Messiah, maybe that seemed as make-believe to Esau as it does to people living today. I wonder if in his mind he went something like this. He comes in and he smells the stew. I wonder if in his mind he says, "You want my birthright? I mean, I'm starving to death here. What good is a birthright to me? I mean, our father doesn't own any land except for the grave that our grandparents are buried in. That's the only thing he owns. We just live here because somebody lets us live here. And you want me to trade you my part in some promise God made to our granddad, a promise that 400 years from now, that my son, great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will come back and live in this land, that my 10 great-grandchildren... they're going to come back and they're going to live and take this land away from the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Girgashites and the Termites." And I mean, you want that? And you want me to trade this promise that one day, someday, maybe hundreds of years after that, that one of our descendants is going to become the savior of the world? Give me the soup, bro. I don't know what he thought. But it's pretty clear to me that Esau never really valued the eternal promises that God made to his father and his grandfather. Turn over to chapter 26, verse 34. What you have in chapter 26 is a series of snapshots of Isaac's life. Much of it reads like a repeat of Abraham's life. And what you see in Isaac both here and what we just read about him praying for 20 years for his wife to have a child, what you see is, for the most part, you see that Isaac is a man of faith. He's flawed, not perfect faith, but a man, and he's gonna mess up pretty bad coming. But right here in chapter 26, he's a man who by faith patiently endures difficulty. One little mishap, we'll talk about that. But he's a man who is resting and trusting in God's promise to his father Abraham. That's what chapter 26 is about. But then you get to the end, and verse 34 is just kind of thrown in there. Verse 34 is, after all this about Isaac being a man of faith and patiently enduring and being blessed by God, and people recognizing the blessing. You see, when Esau was 40 years old, same age Isaac, his father, was when he got married, Esau took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. In other words, he married Canaanite women. Now, Abraham had made it perfectly clear that neither his sons or, by implication, his grandsons should not marry Canaanite women. But again, you see, Esau doesn't care about that. And so here we have chapters 26 that talks about how Isaac was walking by faith and God was blessing him. And bookended on each side of this story of Isaac's faithfulness is this picture of Esau despising his birthright and then defying his parents' wishes in marrying outside the clan. Clearly, Esau doesn't care about the blessing his grandfather and father live for. He simply lived for the moment, the here and now, not for some distant, invisible promise. And that's the way the New Testament talks about this part of the story as well in Hebrews 12:15. Hebrews 12:15 says, "See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. And see to it that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who missed grace." Remember, that's what this is about. "See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace. Don't be like Esau, who missed grace by selling his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears." Yep. God is sovereignly choosing the people through whom Messiah will one day come. Yes, he's doing that, and he's choosing flawed, undeserving people. But our choices matter. Our choices matter. How does all that work? It's a mystery to me. But, you ask, doesn't that mean that our choices that God's choices are dependent on our choices? No. Remember, God freely chose Jacob over Esau before they were born, before they had done anything good or bad. You say, okay, but doesn't that mean that God's choices then are based on his foreknowledge of if we'll choose for him or against him? No. God didn't reject Esau because he was a much worse sinner than Jacob. We're going to see just how bad Jacob is. Remember, we are all rotten and flawed. And if God's choice was based on foreknowledge, it would have to be based on works. And Romans tells us it's not based on performance. It's not based on how we do. No, it doesn't work that way either. Well, then, you say, Esau didn't have any chance. He wasn't elect. God just didn't choose him. God's not fair. It's true that God didn't choose Esau to be the carrier of the messianic seed. But the story doesn't tie up in this neat little bow, does it? Because we see God sovereignly choosing the people through whom the promised blessing will come. And at the same time, we see people who are responsible for believing the promises and acting in line with them. And how that works out, I don't have to know. I don't have to know how it all works out. I just have to trust that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob knows what he's doing. And I'm absolutely certain from the way this story is told and from the New Testament commentary on this story that God means this story to be a warning to us. Esau is a warning. You see, it's not that he just made one or two mistakes in his life. That's not it at all. Esau's problem was he did not value his place among God's people. So when it came to the specific time of making these decisions, he had already made the decision a long time ago. Because to him, to trust in invisible promises was not something he could taste, touch, feel, get his mind around. And you know something? It's not too different for us today. Because if you know Christ, you are living with a future promise in mind. And we're tempted by red stuff every day. We live our jobs, our careers, every commercial, every magazine ad, all are promising freedom and fulfillment right here, right now. It's there for the taking. But like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we're called to live as strangers and sojourners in this world, to live by faith with our hope set on a better world to come. We don't have a promise that here and now this life will be easy. We see all kinds of things that promise immediate fulfillment. We hear all kinds of voices that tell us that all of this is real and all of what we believe by faith, is it real? Is it really real? Yeah, we have, and this is the great thing. You see, if you're a Christ follower, you have received the promised blessing of God's presence in the person of Christ. We do have His power, His Spirit living inside us. But you can't necessarily touch those things. You can't. You see, if we don't hold those things as having highest value, then when the world offers us the red stuff, it'll be very tempting to bite. Every day and every way, we're given opportunities to make decisions and choices, choices that matter. And the question is, what do you value most? The things of God or the red stuff of this world? You see, Esau gives us a chance to check what we value most. So here's the big idea so far. God is calling to Himself a people to enjoy His blessing and to extend His blessing to all peoples. And He's freely choosing the people through whom the promise will come. All of them are flawed, and the choices they make matter. I know, it's still dogging you though, isn't it? You're still wrestling with Esau. You're still thinking, but what chance did Esau have? If God chose Jacob and not Esau, what chance did he have? Remember, we're not talking about who goes to heaven and who goes to hell here. Don't read that into every part of the Bible. This is about who carries the promise forward. The promise of a Messiah. Who carries that forward? You see, Esau had the same chance we have. Esau would have to have sought the blessing through Jacob. He would have had to understand God was going to work His plan through his younger brother. And if he stayed rightly related to Jacob, then he could have inherited the blessing. You say, well, man, that's pretty hard. I mean, to believe that your very own brother is like the one that's bearing the promise of inheriting this land and a savior? Is that really so hard to get your mind around? Is that really so hard to get your mind around? We have a whole book in the New Testament written by James, the half-brother of Jesus who grew up in the home of Jesus, and James had to come to a point of understanding that salvation and God's presence and power and blessing would come through his older brother. Is it really so hard to get our minds around the fact that we cannot earn or deserve the blessing ourselves, but we have to seek the blessing through another, through Jacob's descendant, Jesus? You see, this isn't a story of these people. It's not a story about, does Jacob go to heaven and Esau goes to hell? This story is about how God will make it possible for people to go to heaven. And God is choosing individuals through whom He will eventually come the Jewish people, through whom will eventually come the Messiah, through whom will ultimately come the restoration of all things. And in Him, in Jesus, Jacob's descendant, anyone, everyone, Arab, Jew, Gentile, who comes to God through faith in Christ, enters in to that blessing that was promised way back to Abraham and was believed by Isaac. And Jacob will eventually get his mind around it. But you come through another person. You come through the promised blessing of Abraham. You come through Jesus. And through Him, you become a part of God's family. And I love this phrase in Hebrews. There's a phrase in Hebrews that says, we've all come. When we come to Christ, we come
as the church of the firstborn, meaning we all become firstborn and inherit the blessing. Would you bow your head and close your eyes? If you want to be a part of what God is doing in the world, all you need to do is trust not in yourself, not in religion, not in church, but trust in Jesus to make you right with God and to give you life forever. We're all flawed. We're all sinners. But being a child of God depends on what Jesus did for us, not what we do for Him. And the way is open, but you got to come through Him. And if you want to be a part of God's people and God's purpose, you can make that choice now by trusting in the promise. God's promise. He said it this way. Jesus put it this way. It's just as simple as it possibly can be. I tell you the truth. The one who trusts in me has everlasting life. God, we want you to know we trust you. We ask you to forgive us for our faithlessness. Forgive us for chasing after red stuff, thinking it's more valuable than a relationship with you and your people. We want you to know, though, more than anything else, we value Jesus most. And we trust Him to do in us what we cannot do for ourselves. Thank you.